write one for myself. This little volume is the result. And I should like to put your name on it in memory of our long friendship. In these days when the wildest fictions are so much less improbable than the facts.
Clubland Heroes. Ian Trewin presents a series of portraits of the men who created these thrillers and whose heroes are still often portrayed in the cinema and on television. This week, he examines the thrillers of John Buchan.
They were never great literature, but the novels of John Buchan, like the others in this series, among them Sapper, Dawnford Yeats, and Edgar Wallace, were the staple reading for millions between the wars. They created characters who've lived on for more than 50 years. Richard Hannay, Bulldog Drummond, Barry Playdell, The Four Just Men, and The Saint. It was the critic Richard Usborne who coined the phrase, Clubland Heroes, because the heroes of Sapper, Buchan and Yeats in particular, were essentially West End clubmen. Their beefy type of hero was a man's man. His club in St. James's meant a lot to him. It offered him a fortress with many of the amenities of home, but without the distractions of his womenfolk. Heroes of the age tended, wrote Usborne, to be recruited from the leisured classes. This was certainly true of John Buchan's principal hero, Richard Hannay. We first meet Hannay in Buchan's best-known and thrice-filmed novel, The 39 Steps, trying to prevent British naval secrets falling into the hands of the Germans just before the First World War and being chased half across Scotland for his trouble.
From my vantage ground, I could scan the whole moor right away to the railway line and to the south of it, where green fields took the place of the heather. I have eyes like a hawk, but I could see nothing moving in the whole countryside. Then I looked beyond the ridge and saw a new kind of landscape. Shallow green valleys with plentiful fir plantations and the faint lines of dust which spoke of high roads. Last of all, I looked into the blue May sky, and there I saw that which set my pulses racing. Low down in the south, a monoplane was climbing into the heavens. I was as certain as if I'd been told that that aeroplane was looking for me, and that it did not belong to the police.
Now, of course, the essence of the Buchan approach in the thriller is that the hero is supposed to be staying away from the enemy, but all the time you know that Buchan is remorselessly driving him nearer and nearer and nearer. I think that his strength, his extraordinary strength of movement, might be that he almost took the line in writing thrillers which General Grant put forward in Winning Battles. Find the enemy where you can, hit him as hard as you can, and keep on moving.
Owen Dudley Edwards, giving a critic's eye view of the novels. But what of the writer himself?
I was especially fascinated by the notion of hurried journeys. In the great romances of literature, they provide some of the chief dramatic moments. And since the theme is common to Homer and the Penny Reciter, it must appeal to a very ancient instinct in human nature. We live our lives under the twin categories of time and space. And when the two come into conflict, we get the great moment. Whether failure or success is the result, life is sharpened, intensified, idealized. A long journey, even with the most lofty purpose, may be a dull thing to read of if it is made at leisure. But 100 yards may be a breathless business if only a few seconds are granted to complete it. For then, it becomes a sporting event, a race. And the interest which makes millions read of the Derby is the same, in a grosser form, as when we follow an expedition straining to relieve a beleaguered fort, or a man fleeing to a sanctuary with the avenger behind him.
John Buchan's father was a minister of the Free Church of Scotland in Perth. But by 1888, when John was 13, the family had moved to the Gorbals district of Glasgow. As the young Buchan walked daily to school, and later to the city's university, he passed its tenements, warehouses and factories. Deprivation was always near at hand. But during the holidays, the Buchans repaired to his mother's family home, 12 miles up the Tweed from Peebles. and his love of the Scottish countryside, which he was to espouse throughout his life, was undoubtedly born of these visits. Janet Adam Smith, Buchan's biographer, believes that his upbringing in Scotland instilled in him a passion for hard work. He was always able to combine writing with the law, with politics, or with diplomacy.
I think it started in his childhood in the manse in Glasgow with a very determined and efficient mother who organized her life and the life of her family on a very slender income, very well indeed, by being practical, businesslike, on the spot. And I think John Buchan always knew he had his own way to make in the world. There was no money and no great influence behind him, and I think he knew that he would have to be not just hard working, but very careful in planning out his time and planning his energies from the very beginning.
From Glasgow University, Buchan won a scholarship to Brasenose College, Oxford, paying his way as an undergraduate by writing stories, literary criticism, and two novels. After Oxford, it was London and the law, supporting himself by journalism while working for his exams. He was called to the bar in 1901, but a feeling of restlessness made him volunteer for work in South Africa as an aide to the High Commissioner, Lord Milner. But Buchan's coming of age as a writer was the 39 Steps, written during an illness early in the First World War. A duodenal ulcer had kept him out of the war and was to trouble him for the rest of his life.
I invented a young South African called Richard Hannay, who had traits copied from my friends, and I amused myself with considering what he would do in various emergencies.
His eldest son, the second Lord Tweedsmuir, recalls how Buchan actually planned his novels with his often complicated plots.
He did it in the most fascinating way because he generally started at the end. He would get some totally irreconcilable people, put them together in a hut in the Welsh hills or something, and then prepare a perfectly clear, lucid explanation about how they came to get them. But perhaps an example of that was the 39 Steps. My sister and I were taken to the sea at Broadstairs, and my father was, I suppose, filling in his time as best he could, and he saw this flight of steps, which incidentally there aren't 39, down from a low cliff to the sea beach, and he thought to himself, now, one could end a book for those steps. Either good men pursued down them by evil, or evil men pursued down them by good. He worked the whole of 39 Steps backwards from that.
I want to write a shocker, so I begin by fixing on one or two facts which have no sort of obvious connection. Let us take three things a long way apart. Say, an old blind woman spinning in the Western Highlands, a barn in a Norwegian setter, and a little curiosity shop in North London kept by a Jew with a dyed beard. Not much connection between the three? You invent a connection. The reader is pleased with the ingenuity of the solution, for he doesn't realize that the author fixed upon the solution first and invented the problem to suit it.
Many of them start in fairly humdrum settings, but they move out very quickly. It's always possible for a venture round the corner, and I think that they do appeal to the young, particularly for that, not just for the grip of the story, but also for the sense that, out there, it might be just in the middle of Malibran, as well as in the middle of a Scottish moor, but out there, anything may happen. Life is full of possibilities. The adventure certainly doesn't depend upon violence. I mean, there are violent happenings occasionally, but they're never written up. They're never elaborated for the sake of violence. I think it's the invitation into a world of event rather than into a world of violent adventure.
Weakness winning against might. Gentleness and courtesy against brutality. Brains against mere animal strength. The one chance in 100 succeeding. The scale must be weighted against the hero. His task must be made as difficult as possible, for how otherwise can we get the full drama? How otherwise can ordinary folk be persuaded that life has color in it, and a wide horizon.
It's not too difficult to trace the models for Buchan's characters. Richard Hannay, for instance, owes much to a man he'd met in South Africa, General Ironside. So what about the others?
The outstanding one is Sandy Arbuthnot, who, perhaps not so much in point of character as in experience, was modelled very much on Aubrey Herbert, who was a very colourful character, who at one time, I believe, was asked to be King of Albania, but who had had adventures in the Near East, just as Sandy Arbuthnot had, was liable to pop up in a remote Khan on the Persian border, all that kind of thing.
Aubrey Herbert, gentle, whimsical, utterly courageous, lived to be a Member of Parliament and to have a fantastic record in various terrains of the war. He was taken prisoner in the retreat from Mons when armed with an alpenstock. He must have presented a figure like Don Quixote's. And knowing Turkish, during a truce at Gallipoli, he is said to have taken command of a Turkish unit and escorted it back to its trenches. To go tandem driving with him at Oxford required fortitude, for he was very blind. To mountaineer with him deserved a Victoria Cross, for he was both blind and desperate.
But rather interestingly, when Sandy Arbuthnot appears in one of Buchan's later novels, The Corpse of the Morning, lo and behold, he shrunk. I mean, the actual physical description of him shows him as a much shorter man, and his exploits are modeled very much upon T.E. Lawrence's. And of course, T.E. Lawrence was a small man. So that in that sense, the fictional character has absorbed bits of two real people.
I do not profess to have understood T.E. Lawrence fully, still less to be able to portray him. There is no brush fine enough to catch the subtleties of his mind, no aerial viewpoint high enough to bring into one picture the manifold of his character. I am not a very tractable person nor much of a hero worshipper, but I could have followed Lawrence over the edge of the world. I loved him for himself, and also because there seemed to be reborn in him all the lost friends of my youth. If genius be, in Emerson's phrase, a stellar and undiminishable something whose origin is a mystery and whose essence cannot be defined, then he was the only man of genius I have ever known.
And Buchan's characters were firmly set in the landscapes that he knew and loved.
All his physical descriptions of countryside generally are all very firmly based upon countryside that he'd known and appreciated. Although he had a capacity, through books, maps, and imagination, of imagining a countryside he'd not visited very accurately. And when, on his first visit to America, he was taken down to the South to visit Civil War battlefields and so forth in Virginia, one of his American hosts was startled to find that he had not been in America when he wrote his Virginian novel, Salute to Adventurers. He said it was so absolutely true to the landscape and the countryside. I think he had a very special feel for landscape.
I remember coming back from the Arctic. I'd been a Hudson Bay Company fur trader in Baffinland just before the war started. He was writing his last novel, Sickheart River. Most of it was about a northern winter. And he asked me to sit down beside him and tell him 10 things that it felt like midwinter in the Arctic. I don't think I managed 10, but I managed about 4 or 5. Just thinking back now, the breath of husky dogs rising in orange clouds in the dawn, the squeak of the sledge runners, and you've got the hard patch of snow ice, thud of the dog's feet, every single hair on your face and the dog's muzzles too, absolutely etched out in white with the frost. And there's perhaps there were 1 or 2 other things as well. And all these made a very, very good picture too.
The cold was more intense than anything he had ever imagined. Under its stress, trees cracked with a sound like machine guns. The big morning fire made only a narrow circle of heat. If for a few seconds he turned his face from it, The air stung his eyelids as if with an infinity of harsh particles. To draw breath rasped his throat. The sky was milk pale, the sun a mere ghostly disk. And it seemed to Leeson as if everything, sun, trees, mountains, were red and rimmed. There was no shadow anywhere, no depth or softness. The world was hard, glassy, metallic. All of it except the phantasmal cotton-wool skies.
In dedicating the 39 steps to Tommy Nelson of the Edinburgh publishers with whom he worked, Buchan likens it to what Americans used to call the dime novel, and what he disparagingly referred to as a shocker. So who were his literary influences?
When he was a schoolboy and a young undergraduate at Glasgow, he read a tremendous lot. He had a very wide range. But I think that two of the writers who particularly influenced him were Walter Pater and Robert Louis Stevenson, both of them great stylists, and it was Stevenson the stylist rather than Stevenson the storyteller then. And I think he had the capacity, as Stevenson noted about himself, that a place would set up a question in his mind, what kind of adventure would be suitable to have happened in this place. Stevenson describes how he saw the Hawes Inn at Queen's Ferry and thought, what might have happened in this place? Kidnapped. Well, and Buchan, in the same way, once when he was cruising in the Aegean, they stopped at a small island in, I think, one of the Petali Islands, and just by the quay there was a wall and a big door. Somebody told them, or they may have seen, a big house behind, but quite secluded. And that at once set up the idea of what might happen in such a house on such a position. The idea simmered in his head, and about 10 years later, he wrote The Dancing Floor.
Although it's the shockers we remember, Buchan was prolific in other literary fields. He wrote many historical novels and several distinguished biographies, Montrose, Oliver Cromwell, and Sir Walter Scott. I'm left wondering how he managed with a large output, for by the mid-20s, he was an MP as well as a publisher, and in 1935 he became Governor General of Canada and was created Lord Tweedsmuir. He was Lord High Commissioner to the Assembly of the Church of Scotland and Chancellor of Edinburgh University, as well as a member of the Privy Council. His daughter Alice explains how he managed to fit in his writing with his public duties.
I think he arranged his time, arranged his thoughts and his life, so there was time. And there's no doubt that the more you do, if you do that, the more time there is. And somehow there was more time than this. Of course, he lived in a house with a great many servants. And he didn't drive a car. He had a chauffeur and all that sort of thing after he began to make money. But I don't think that's entirely it. I think he just had this marvelous capacity for work. He wrote it either on the big desk in the library or he wrote in a room he built upstairs where he could be quite quiet. But he could write on his knee. He could write in the train. He could write while we were all talking, laughing, laughing. He could even write while the piano was going. We were rehearsing play. I mean, he had this marvelous gift of them, extracting his mind. Stories simply spring out of their mind. One follows another. And I think he'd no sooner finished one book than he had already begun to plan in his mind another one.
As witness to this, we have his wife, Susan, who in her 90s was to recall...
She always wrote in the morning. At 12:30, we would put down the writing and read the Times. And then go out in the afternoon. He never worked at night. His stories, he always said, were in his head. And if you look at his manuscripts, you'll see that they're hardly corrected at all.
Buchan is often charged with anti-Semitism. Early in the 39 steps, a character makes some disparaging remarks about the real bosses of big business being Jews. 10-1, you are brought up against a little white-faced Jew in a bath chair with an eye like a rattlesnake. Well, this sounds pretty offensive to us in 1980. But remember, when Buchan wrote it in 1915, such remarks were commonplace and considered no worse than, say, mean as an Aberdonian.
Very often they are made by characters like the South African Hane, in whom it would have been natural to their character to talk in that way. And here we must always remember this historical fact that, I mean, people talking disparagingly of a Jew in 1910 or 1911 were probably thinking of financiers, houses in Park Lane, fortunes in the mines in South Africa. You were not speaking of people who had been oppressed politically or who had been massacred by Hitler. In the 1930s, Buchan very much took up the question of the Jews in Palestine. He was a keen pro-Zionist. But at a time when it seemed the British mandate was anti-Jew, Buchan was forever standing up for the rights of Jews in Palestine, and he addressed an enthusiastic meeting, largely of Jews, in Shoreditch in 1934, in defense of Jews in Palestine, at a time when Mosley, with his army of British anti-Semitic fascists, were making these provocative marches through the Jewish East End.
It's ironic that although Buchan poured himself into his biographies and his historical novels, it's for the shockers that he's chiefly remembered. The thrillers of John Buchan are classics of their kind. Owen Dudley Edwards.
One of the things which is rather splendid about him, and cheerfully impudent, is that he asserts his claim, it seems to me, in the 39 Steps, to be in the great tradition of escape and escapist literature very well, when the literary innkeeper says, "Man, it's all pure Conan Doyle and Rider Haggard," and there's old Buchan saying, "That's me, boys, and I'm in the league too." And I think to do him justice, he is.
For all I knew, half those boxes might be dynamite. If the cupboard held such deadly explosives, why not the boxes? In that case, there would be a glorious skyward journey for me and the German servants and about an acre of the surrounding country. There was also the risk that the detonation might set off the other bricks in the cupboard, for I had forgotten most that I knew about Venonite. But it didn't do to begin thinking about the possibilities. The odds were horrible, but I had to take them. I ensconced myself just below the sill of the window, lit the fuse, then I waited for a moment or two. There was dead silence, only a shuffle of heavy boots in the passage and the peaceful cluck of the hens from the warm out of doors. I commended my soul to my maker and wondered where I would be in 5 seconds. A great wave of heat seemed to surge upwards from the floor and hang for a blistering instant in the air. Then the wall opposite me flashed into a golden yellow and dissolved with a rending thunder that hammered my brain into a pulp. Something dropped on me, catching the point of my left shoulder. And then I think I became unconscious. In the first of our series, Clubland Heroes, Ion Trewin has been looking at the thrillers of John Buchan. The readers were Simon Lack and Michael McLean, and the producer was John Knight.